This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT. I'm Jennifer Staten.
At the height of their international visibility and political power, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. recognized in each other a kindred spirit whose very presence helped them fulfill their respective roles. Their dual strategies, in retrospect, amplified and built each other up. Malcolm's envelope-pushing militancy offered Martin leverage against allegations that he was a communist or worse. Martin's aura of political moderation aided Malcolm's quest to galvanize America's black underdogs.
That's Peniel Joseph, Barbara Jordan Professor of Political Values and Ethics at the LBJ School of Public Affairs, reading from his most recent book, The Sword and the Shield, The Revolutionary Lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. In it, Joseph argues history has pigeonholed each man into a narrow role when actually they each were both sword and shield. We talked earlier this year before the coronavirus pandemic started and before protests over police killings of black people about a broader vision of Malcolm X and King and about their connection to movements today.
Malcolm X is not just this political sword. He's also a person who's talking about human rights. He actually says that if whites were willing to peacefully integrate racially, even before he left the Nation of Islam, he'd be fine with racial integration. He just felt that black people shouldn't have to beg to be accepted in the society and be treated as citizens. And King is not just this peaceful warrior. He's absolutely this nonviolent civil rights leader, but he comes to bring the sword too. And that sword is this movement against not just racial injustice, but poverty and war. King breaks with Lyndon Johnson over the Vietnam War. King organizes this Poor People's Campaign, which is this multiracial, multicultural struggle. King is really a big critic of American democracy and the gaps between the rhetoric of American democracy and its reality.
Why did each of them evolve in the way that they did over time?
Malcolm really feels that structural racism and the histories of racial slavery and white supremacy in the United States, they really mandate that it's going to take force to bring about black dignity in the United States. And what he means by dignity is an end to poverty, an end to police brutality, an end to forced racial segregation. He says there's a difference between racial separation and racial segregation. I think over time, Malcolm starts to see, not just after leaving the Nation of Islam, but while in the Nation of Islam, that things like voting rights matter. Trying to transform democratic institutions actually matter. Political coalitions matter. That the only way to produce that black dignity that he's been preaching as part of the Nation of Islam requires reaching out and being more adaptable and growing his worldview. He travels to the Middle East in 1959 and then again throughout 1964 and Europe, and that's going to transform his worldview as well. Political experience inspires change for Martin Luther King Jr. So after the March on Washington and after the passage of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, one of the key moments for Dr. King is the Watts Uprising in Los Angeles. So that happens August 11th, 1965, 5 days after Lyndon Johnson signs the Voting Rights Act. And he sees so much poverty and so much brutality in Los Angeles. King starts to see that to achieve his notion of radical black citizenship is not just one free of racial oppression, it's one that includes rights. And the rights are rights to food justice, rights to a decent housing, rights to guaranteed living wage, good jobs, a decent life. He starts to see that he needs to go further and have a bigger critique. As the 60s progresses, he starts to make an argument that the only way American democratic institutions can be transformed is from the bottom up. Not forcefully, never forcefully, but is it revolutionary? Yes, he's interested in redistributive justice, and that's where they start to converge.
Is there kind of a line, though, violence, nonviolence? I mean, is there sort of a non-negotiable there? Because they didn't overlap there.
They didn't overlap there. And those are issues of tactics. I think that they both, by 1964, believe that political coercion is going to be required. Malcolm, he never takes violence off the table, but he does say that if the United States has a real commitment to human rights, and that white liberals have a real commitment to human rights, they can be part of this movement to transform society. King, violence is never on the table, but King acknowledges that the growing gap between the rich and poor means that violence is really, the country is more susceptible to violence. King always describes riots as the language of the unheard and the oppressed.
Re-examining and kind of reclassifying or expanding the narratives of Malcolm X and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., does that then necessitate looking at the 50s and the 60s of our history a little differently?
Absolutely, Jennifer. I think it really makes us re-examine and reimagine these movements for racial and economic and political justice in the 1950s and the 1960s, and their relationship with the political liberalism of the 1960s and the 1950s. And it really connects us to today, because we think about Malcolm and Martin and things like March for Our Lives and women's marches, and obviously the Black Lives Matter movement, marches for immigration rights and for the rights of Muslims and the rights for trans people and LGBTQ, this intersectional justice. Those two were really some of the co-authors of those movements. The movements that we have today have further expanded what they were talking about, but they were really thinking about identity and citizenship and freedom in extraordinary ways. And I think by pigeonholing them as that sword versus that shield, we really lose the nuances and the subtleties of that period.
I'm wondering also if those old narratives stick in place because they were written mostly by white people?
Certainly the journalists of the period were predominantly white, who set us up with the framings of Malcolm and Martin. Absolutely. There's a black press that has a different framing of both of them, but the black press's framing has not won out when we think about textbooks, when we think about our common knowledge collectively. So I do think that right now, we have much more robust African-American history that's being written by a range of people, but certainly black scholars have a chance to shape the interpretation of the way in which these figures are being thought about and the legacies that they have in our contemporary time in a way that they didn't in the 1950s and the 1960s. Both Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. are revolutionaries. They're going to have different tactics and strategies, but over time, those tactics and strategies actually converge both in their lifetimes. What's so interesting about both of their assassinations is that they leave terrible holes and voids, but those issues are still struggled with throughout the next decade up until today. The movement didn't end, but what you did lose were these principal figures who are able to attract both outsized media attention globally and also able to attract political coalitions based on people who are interested in the way in which they articulated the quest for both citizenship and dignity.
Peniel Joseph is the Barbara Jordan Chair of Political Values and Ethics at the LBJ School of Public Affairs and is also director of the LBJ School Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. His latest book is The Sword and the Shield, The Revolutionary Lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. Peniel, thank you so much for your time and discussion today.
Thank you, Jennifer, so much for having me.